You have 15 minutes, and if you'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal, we will be happy to do that.
May I reserve 5 minutes?
Certainly.
May it please the court. My name is Martin Speroni. I represent Nathaniel McCoy, the appellant in this case. An alleged accomplice testified against the defendant. This alleged accomplice was also charged with first-degree murder, the same crime as McCoy. And the witness cut a deal. His first-degree murder was not prosecuted, no cross. When the defendant wanted to cross-examine as to bias by asking what penalty the witness had avoided, the trial court did not allow him to do that. That was not exposed to the jury. And I believe
correct that the trial court did allow him to be questioned as to what charge had been dismissed or not crossed.
Absolutely correct. What charge it was, yes, but not what penalty he was avoiding. I concede that the cross-examination for bias bar was not absolute. It was only partial. As we know...
Excuse me, the jury knew the plea agreement that murder one was reduced to murder two.
That is correct, Your Honor. But...
And then, wasn't there other evidence of bias?
There was some limited examination of bias, but I believe that the full examination of bias should have been explored. There is no reason to curtail that, other than what we know, harassment, prejudice, confusion, witness safety, repetitive, or being marginally relevant. None of those factors came into play.
This is Ferrani. Isn't the only thing that the judge prohibited counsel from questioning was, in fact, the sentence range on murder one?
That is basically correct, Your Honor. The depth of the sentence that the witness was avoiding was what was not allowed in front of the jury.
Well, ultimately, that would have been... He was testifying against a co-defendant, which was on trial for murder one. So
absolutely,
that would have been provided to the jury prior to the determination of guilt and sentencing, the sentence range for his sentence as well, wouldn't it?
It would. And under normal circumstances, that would be improper as irrelevant. But the Commonwealth made it relevant. When the Commonwealth charged, then cut a deal to no pros and made that witness testify, it made the depth of that bias a relevant matter. It made the sentencing range relevant. Imagine, for example, that we have three witnesses, all in the same boat. They've been charged with something, some with a higher crime, some with the same crime, some with a lesser crime. Are we developing then a blind spot? We can ask what the range is for the one that had the higher crime that was no cross, the one that avoided on the lesser crime, but we develop a blind spot for the jury on the exact crime that the defendant has committed or has been charged with. And if we develop that blind spot, it's a fairly large blind spot because many accomplices are going to be charged with the same crime.
Counsel, couldn't you have achieved the same thing by simply asking if murder one carries significant more time than murder two?
Perhaps, and in some cases there was...
That would have been the same result, wouldn't it?
Maybe similar, Your Honor, but I think that exploring the depth of the bias is what's important. I don't see a need to fetter that exploration. There are some cases where they talk about lots and lots of prison time, and it's a way to get there, I guess. But in this case, there was no such exploration. The only way that the jury would have known what was avoided is if they knew by themselves what... range of penalties a first-degree murder would have.
Does the record indicate that it was any proffer to indicate that the witness actually knew what the range of punishment was for the charge that was reduced?
If memory serves, the question was asked, but the judge told the witness not to answer. He said the questions were being proffered for the record.
How do we know then that the witness even knew what that range of punishment was?
If the witness was not allowed to answer the question, we would not know.
I understand, but suppose the witness had said, "I don't know," in response to your question. Wouldn't that have been the end of it?
Perhaps, but...
So you're asking us to speculate, in effect, that his answer would have somehow been impeachment evidence.
Yes, and I definitely think that the answer would be impeachment evidence. Even if he did not know exactly the figure, he would know, like in other cases, that lots and lots of prison time had been avoided.
Well, wasn't that fair argument to the jury? That lots and lots of prison time had been avoided as a result of it? I mean, any good attorney is going to make that argument, regardless of whether the witness had actually given you the statutory range of punishment for the offense.
Perhaps Your Honor is correct. The question here is that they were not allowed to understand or be exposed to that particular violence. I believe the test to be used is the one that looks at abuse of discretion. We look at these factors. Was asking that question harassing, prejudicial, confusing, affect witness safety? Was it repetitive or marginally relevant? And I'm going to say no, it was neither of those. It should have allowed to go forward. The key question, I think, is whether this was harmless error. And that we can look under the non-constitutional error provided by in court in Code 801-678, where if we have a fair trial and substantial justice, the ruling will stand. Or, like in this case, if it was a constitutional error, the cross-examination on bias is a constitutional issue error. And for that, the test is, was the error harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? And my thinking is this. In order to find harmless error in this constitutional issue, this court would have to be convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the verdict would have been the same if the jury had thought that that single witness that put the McCoy at the scene of the crime was in fact lying.
I was just looking at the appendix. The question that you wanted to ask, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but the question you proffered to the court had to do with his probation violation charge, not his first-degree murder charge. Am I incorrect there?
I did not read it the way Your Honor seems to be reading.
The court said, before you make your argument, proffer what the question is going to be, because the objection did come as you were literally partially into the question. And the response was, sir, isn't it true that you are facing 2.5 years potential for the probation violation on the crimes against nature charge?
I believe that was part of it. However, the key part that I think has us here today is that the jury was not allowed to be exposed to the full bias.
But that is the only question that you proffered to the judge that you wanted to ask.
I inherited this case, Your Honor. It was Rosenberg.
And I apologize.
I'll have to check on that, and I will do so in a moment. But I think that the question was very specifically related to the range, which is what the Commonwealth objected to under Rule 3A 17.1.
Thank you. So you have 6 minutes remaining. Would you want to save that for your rebuttal time?
Yes, please. Thank you, Your Honor.
I was on page 111 on the appendix where that question was from.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Leah Darren for the Commonwealth. Getting directly to Judge Petty's questioning about the proffer and what the witness was asked. First of all, it does appear that while on page 111 of the transcript that the questioning started off with the probation issue that the witness was facing, but it certainly evolves into on pages 113 and 114 and 115. And of course, the witness is present sitting in the courtroom while all of this discussion is going on. So, you know, we did not argue failure to proffer because, of course, the the argument on the motion is telling the witness what the range of punishment is that he was facing initially and what the reduced range of punishment was as a result.
A lot of witnesses like that still wouldn't know what the range was.
Well, that might be true, Judge, but we did not make that proffer argument for that reason. We have made a waiver argument at the initial part of our brief, and we do rely on that, but I will move on to our main argument, and that is that the trial court certainly had the discretion under the Yen. Please forgive me for mispronouncing cases. That won't be the last time I do so. But the Yen case certainly stands for the proposition, and quoting the Virginia Supreme Court, that the trial court has the discretion to limit the scope of cross-examination, which is for the purpose of establishing bias. And so that's the standard of review the court needs to apply in this case. And so what we have here is a tension between the defendant's right to cross-examine a witness about bias and a statute which says, and that's 19.2.295.1, which says that we are not going to allow juries to hear the range of punishment at the guilt phase of a bifurcated trial. And the purpose of that.
The actual purpose of the question, not so much to establish bias as to establish motive to testify falsely.
Certainly.
That be a benefit.
Yes, certainly.
And the jury had already heard what would constitute a motive to testify falsely, and that is the plea agreement itself.
Yes, that's correct. So that would go on to our argument about why the judge did not abuse his discretion in this case.
Was there other evidence of bias?
Certainly, Your Honor. The other evidence of bias in this case was, number one, that Mr. Johnson was a convicted felon, and he faced, he was on probation, and he faced revocation on crimes against nature. That's at page 109 of the record. He pleaded guilty. He had a charge reduced. He had charges for conspiracy to commit murder and wounding in the commission of a felony, and a first-degree murder charge that was null prost. In exchange for his cooperation, he had a plea agreement. The plea agreement was placed into evidence. That's at page 118 of the record. He had no agreement as to sentence, and I think this was important, that the Commonwealth had the sole discretion to decide whether this witness, Mr. Johnson, had cooperated fully. And so that certainly is a strong evidence of a motivation to fabricate and to curry favor with the Commonwealth, with strong testimony against Mr. McCoy. So we have the fact that the jury knew all these things. The jury knew about the plea agreement. The only evidence that the court prohibited was the sentencing range that the witness faced on charges that the defendant was also charged with. And so when you have this kind of conflict where we have good reason not to put into evidence at the guilt phase of trial the range of punishment, we don't want that. The purpose is that it promotes that this procedure promotes punishment that's appropriate to the circumstances of the case without corrupting the initial guilt phase with prejudice. So allowing the jury to do what they can't do at the guilt phase at the punishment phase by acquitting a defendant. So we've had many cases, Walls, Lilly, where this issue has come up repeatedly. And certainly more recently in two unpublished cases that are cited in our brief, which are really on all fours with the current case. And that is, again, I apologize, Giraro-Giron and Spencer. They're both cited in our brief. They're both Judge Petty opinions. So we submit that there is no, the trial court did not abuse its discretion, that the court struck a proper balance in this case by the evidence that was allowed in with regard to the witness's motive to fabricate, bias, prejudice against the defendant. And we have also argued on brief that in addition to the extent to which Johnson was impeached, we have evidence against McCoy, including his statement, which indicated that he held a Garrett, I didn't know what a Garrett was, a Garrett, a line-like saw, piano wire in the kind of old, and saw this man's neck with such force that his fingers were practically sawed off. And while a third co-defendant hit the victim in the head some 17 times with a hammer, breaking the hammer off of the handle and then pushing the victim into the water where his body remained for several months before it floated. So all of these facts came out through the defendant's own statement. And importantly, the defendant's own statement showed that Mr. Johnson, while certainly a P2, did not play the active role in this horrible crime that Mr. McCoy and I think is the Purdy, I can't remember the third co-defendant's name. So we would submit that the trial court struck the proper balance. It's an abuse of discretion standard. There was no abuse of discretion here, and we ask the court to affirm the convictions in this case. Are there any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. I believe the Commonwealth answered your question.
I'm satisfied, thank you.
The Guerrero-Giron case, there was a finding there that there was a fair and substantial exploration of the bias. That's what I think this case lacks.
Do you agree with my observation that this appears to be more impeachment by showing a motive or a reason to testify falsely? That is, the acceptance of a benefit, if you will, from the Commonwealth.
I believe that it is that and bias at the same time. I cannot distinguish the two, Your Honor.
Well, isn't the evidence pretty replete with instances such as the plea agreement, the reduction of the charge, all of these benefits that accrued to the witness? Don't all of those establish that motive to testify falsely or even bias, if you will?
They certainly contribute. The question is...
So you get to a point where is this just basically overkill, harmless error?
Whether it would be marginally relevant or cumulative. I would disagree with that because of the magnitude of the 20 years. 20 years is a long time to avoid as a minimum sentence. And while we're on the issue of the evidence, they never found the garrote. There is no physical evidence that links McCoy to the crime. Although there is a police station testimony, that is the only other piece of evidence other than the tainted testimony. The police station statement given by McCoy was unsworn and Mirandized, is the only other piece of evidence that links him to the rest of his crimes. The rest of the evidence, the forensic evidence, corroborates the story in general, but not McCoy's participation in particular.
Thank you. Do you have anything else, Mr. Speroni?
I just request the court look at this in terms of abuse of discretion. Wish that the question had been allowed and reverse the case.
Thank you. We will come down and recount.
All right.